about speaking to the natives, and digital natives, that is. And he comes to us from Discovery Education. He's a former kindergarten teacher, where he moved off to the technology director of his school. It was a set of private schools, and he will share his not-so-unique experience, unfortunately, of trying to convince them of where they needed to go next. And he has some great stories on his strategies to get them to hear what he was saying and what his students needed along the lines of incorporating technology into what they were doing, not only in the classroom, but also in their interactions with parents and each other and other educators across the state. So if you could give a big hand to Steve.
You guys can hear me all right, right? Good morning!
Good morning!
Ready for a good conference?
You bet!
Now, I've never been here before. I didn't really know much about it. I actually had to look up just to double check to see what MEC stood for, and I saw that it stood for microcomputers in education. Any of you have a microcomputer? It's actually kind of funny, though. Just two days ago, I was in Kalamazoo, or scenic Kalamazoo. Trust me, you all want to go there from here. And on the wall there, they had all these different prints from old ads. You know, ads for like the Atari computer, the Radio Shack trashing, and amongst the others, I found this. In case you get it, 64K for $14.95, the most cost-effective way to print for product, most cost-effective products for your microcomputer.
64K.
So, I thought that was kind of interesting. So, we are talking about digital natives, and I know this is kind of an old school term in some sense. The paper that was originally kind of coined that term, the digital native versus digital immigrant, was done by Mark Prensky. And what he was basically saying is anybody who was born before a certain time is a digital immigrant. If you're born after computers, you're a digital native. The rest of us, we can use computers, we can become good at them, but we'll talk with this cute little accent. We'll say things like, if I'm not home tonight, I gotta remember to tape American Idol. No tape in the TiVo, that kind of thing. And so on. So we can still use computers, but we'll still have that little accent behind us. The digital natives are the ones that were growing up with the video games, with DVDs and instant access, and things like microcomputers, and so on and so forth. And in order to really reach these people, that's not what I wanted to do, just in case you need the visual aid, here's your visual aid.
Check out the map.
And since my wife is in marketing, I always feel obligated to point this out. What's the one thing you notice in this picture more than anything?
Apple.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Any of you, when you got your first Apple laptop, wonder why the Apple was upside down?
That's why.
Exactly why. I thought that I could kind of consider myself to be a digital native. I did grow up with computers. I got my first computer, in the mid-80s and so on, and I thought I was pretty slick when it came to technology. And I was pretty high on myself. And then I had a boy.
Yeah.
So he was able to easily go through that iPod and find the stuff that he wanted to watch and listen to and so on. Now with my iPhone, well, I should say his iPhone that I borrow sometimes, he can flip through all the pages. He knows exactly how to find the programs that I downloaded for him, the apps that I bought for him, and he knows which of my apps he likes as well, and so on. It's pretty phenomenal watching him go to work. But that's not all. That's just the tip of the iceberg. He has a permanent record on Google. If you do a search for my son's name, as of a couple days ago, there was 5,400 results. Ain't that kind of scary? Yeah. The kid has got over 2,500 pictures on Flickr. He has over 40 videos on YouTube. He's got a Facebook account. He has two email accounts. Why does he need two email? I don't know. Maybe they're just to separate the spam from the good stuff. I don't know. I want to register for both. But point being, think about this. How many of you in your schools still have a policy that says you cannot... You have a policy? I haven't finished the question yet. A policy that says you cannot use student first and last names along with the photo. Raise your hand. Yeah. You really think when my student, my child, Aiden, is in kindergarten, I'm going to care whether the school allows his first and last name along with the photo? There's 2,500 of them already. you see what I mean? In fact, quite the opposite. I'm going to require that they use his first and last name, along with any work that he does for school online. This is interesting. Am I totally white here and then totally dark here? Sorry. Sorry. Well, ADD thing. Anyway.
Yes.
Look, bright, shiny out there. All right. In my heavens, I'm green. Calm down. All right. Point being, I want them to use his first and last name so that when people do searches on his name, they find the good stuff. The things that represent him well, the professional things, his portfolio, if you will. And that is a dramatic shift that's going to be coming up into our school ranks. And I don't think there's a school in the country that's really well prepared to deal with this next generation of students. It's going to really require a major change in mindset. So, anyone know why when you register for MySpace, it asks you for your age?
To make sure you're...
Why? Marketing, that's one, and you're absolutely right. That's not the stated purpose, but yes, marketing is definitely one. What's the other reason?
Legal.
You are supposed to be a certain age before you join MySpace. Like if you're under 13, you're not supposed to be able to register. So you're right, there is that one. There is one other reason though. When you register, if you're under the age of 16, it will default your profile to as private as possible. As private as possible, so the only people that will see your profile are the people that you expressly give permission to. The people that you say, this person I want, this person, and so on. It won't show up in the regular search. You want to know how to find all the 11, 12, 13, and 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds on MySpace? It's really simple.
99.
What?
99.
You're 16.
Yo, they know you're close. You said they say they're 16. No, they do lie about their age. The middle school mentality, if you're going to lie about your age, well, you go all the way.
See?
It's amazing how many 68-year-olds are graduating in 2011. At this school, I'm graduating in 2011, I live in this town. Maybe they won't say their name. That's okay, their friends will do that for them on the wall.
Right.
It's scary. And they're not thinking through the fact that by doing this, they're also making themselves completely public. They're not really thinking this whole process through, and that's a big problem because it does have implications. This stuff does linger around. Are you guys familiar with a website called College Confidential? Some of you maybe. College Confidential attempts to demystify the college application process. It's a wonderful site. Millions of people are using it. So if somebody says, like, oh, I'm interested in this school, what kinds of questions are they going to ask in the interview? And not only that, what kind of answers are they really looking for? You know, the people are giving their advice like that. So people have been through the application process, alumni, people have gotten in, people have gotten rejected, and so on. It's a great site. And you'll also find things like this. My brother graduated undergrad at Duke, and I'm considering applying. I'm a Hispanic male. My GPA is this. My SAT is this. ACTs are this. I've done these AP courses. What are my chances of getting in? Now, this is great because people can give them advice. Yes, you might be able to get in, but you should probably have a safety school. Maybe you want to try to take these courses before you go, and so on and so forth. But besides alumni, parents, and students, who else is on this site, do you think? The colleges, of course, the admissions departments. They're on this site because they're checking people out. And if somebody happens to catch their eye, they can push them through the process. And if somebody looked at this, somebody at the college admissions department at Duke, wanted to know a little bit more about the Becker Boy 1225, what do you think they would do? What was that? Google it. Of course. Highlight Becker Boy 1225, copy, paste, throw it into Google, and where you will find his PSP customization search. He's hacking PSPs for money so people can play pirated games. Interested? Any questions? Write me at AOL Instant Messenger Becker Boy 1225. That's the first hit that comes up. Now, of course, some might see this as an entrepreneur. Or a distinct lack of ethics. Now, and from there, one more click and we know exactly who that person is, where they're from, and so on and so forth. Is that going to help you get into Duke? Not likely. Not likely. And we're facing this, it's not just MySpace. I was using MySpace as an example. But, you know, Facebook just recently changed their privacy settings. On the plus side, it is possible to do much more granular control over just about everything. Whenever you post just about anything, you can say, I want everybody to see it, or I want just my friends to see it, or I want just my coworkers to see it, or I want everyone to see it except for you. You know, you can do that sort of thing if you want to. That's wonderful. The side effect of that is, though, they also have, by default, made you more public than ever. more public than ever. When you just do a general search for somebody, you can see their profile picture, you can see a sampling of their friends, you can see what groups they are a fan of, and so on and so forth. Now, one way that a lot of people know, if you want to get into somebody else's profile without actually going through them, sometimes you can go through a friend. So they don't need to get through your security, your privacy per se. All they need to do is get through your most promiscuous, is that a word? The friend of yours that is the most promiscuous, that one person who accepts everybody, and they got a nice little sampling to choose from right there. My best friend is an educator in Chicago. And at one point in USA Today, I guess it was a slow news day, they decided to do an article called Educators Gone Wild. And they literally just jumped around Facebook looking for educators with inappropriate things in their profile. So I gave them a warning and a few other friends. I said, listen, hey, be careful what you're putting up on Facebook. I know you're doing it just for fun and for personal. You may think it's private, but rarely is it as private as you think. He said, no. My profile, completely locked down. Nobody can get into it, no big deal. I said, really, want to bet? So we did a little challenge. He unfriended me, okay? And we decided to race to see how quickly I could get into his profile. It took me 15 minutes. You know why? He kept his profile completely private except to friends, family, and groups. That's it. Friends, family, groups. He was a member of the Chicago group, all 6 million people. From what I understand, there's a few members of the Chicago Tribune and Chicago Sun-Times that are also members of that group as well. So the point being, a lot of times you have the ability to make yourself private and to keep this stuff under control, but most people don't quite understand how to go about doing it or how public or private they really are. And that's where the problem kind of comes in. And that's what we're addressing. In fact, now it's even compounded because now there's real-time searching within Google. Now Google has started bringing in things like Twitter posts. Twitter posts that are literally seconds old. They're going to be doing the same thing for Facebook updates as well. I did this morning. I did a search for South by Southwest, which is a conference going on right now. And you literally can see these posts coming in a scroll that says seconds old. See what I mean? It doesn't happen for every Google search, but if you do a kind of a trending or a current Google search, something current going on, like this conference, you'll see it. You'll see latest results, and there will be a little scroll going on. So the stuff is coming in faster and faster than ever before, which is kind of frightening in some sense. I'm going to make sure that this presentation is available later. I'm not going to go through this right now, but there's a great article about privacy settings every Facebook user should know about. Well worth checking out. So the point being, when I was a director of technology, and mind you, Angel mentioned I was a kindergarten teacher until somebody learned that I knew how to fix a printer. Anybody else have that happen? Yeah, be careful. If you know how to fix a printer, keep that quiet. So, I thought at first, as a director of technology, that I was kind of up on things because I knew all about blogging and I was trying to figure out where blogging fit in the education. Then podcasting came along and I kind of jumped on that one and followed that one along and tried to get that involved at our school with mixed results and so on. But then we started getting to wikis and we started getting to Twitter and Facebook and Skype and Avatar Splitter, and it just starts coming fast and furious. In fact, did you know that Web 2.0 site, a new Web 2.0 site, comes out every 48 and a half seconds? I know, it's stunning, isn't it? And it's totally made up. Don't quote that. Okay? But it feels right, doesn't it? It feels like every time you turn around, there's another one out there that you need to be aware of, and so on. It's tricky. And here's where we come back to what Prensky was saying. He was saying that if digital immigrant educators really want to reach these digital natives. The whole point of his article is this, that they're going to have to change, and not just in the we're going to change our policies kind of change, not just we're going to try and tweak the curriculum kind of change, not just the we're going to have a committee and explore this thing kind of change. They're going to have to do the Nike type of change, the just do it type of change, the personally doing it, the not waiting for someone else to tell you that you need to, but to go home and start doing it right now, to experimenting and getting personal experience for yourself. That kind of change, and that's the only way we're going to really be able to reach these students. These are the general characteristics of the digital native, and these are the same sorts of characteristics that we need to start adopting ourselves. We need to become more risk takers, more active knowledge, less fear of failure, and so on and so forth. See, here's the trouble. When I was a director of technology and just throughout the 80s and 90s, this was what was thought of as an online community. You know what I mean? This is the actual email. This actually does still exist today. But that's very different than the online communities that we participate in now. Nowadays, these are the kinds of things that are starting to happen through things like Twitter and such. This is a true story that happened a couple of years ago. This is Jeff Utek and Cheryl Nussbaum Gage. They were actually in Shanghai together, and they learned about a new Web 2.0 site that they've never heard of before called WizIQ. Anybody here know WizIQ? Oh, good. Maybe you can explain it to me later. I really don't understand myself either. But it's some sort of way to do, it's like a virtual meeting and virtual learning space and so on, so people can kind of gather together. They weren't really sure what it was about, but they decided to try and play. But not only were they going to try and play, they sent it out on Twitter. They said, listen, we're trying this out. We don't know where it fits in. We don't know what it does. Here is where we are going and where we are playing. And they sent out a link. And within the span of about 15, 20 minutes, they had people from South Korea, from New Zealand, from Australia, from all over the place were joining in. And each of those people that came in, they started sharing that link out as well. So then it started spreading people in North America and South America and so on and so forth. Before long, there was about 50 or 60 different educators that were all interacting in this space. And what they were doing is they were just kind of hammering this site and figuring out, does this fit for 6th grade? Does this fit for 12th grade? Is this good for elementary? Could we use this for a collaboration space if we really wanted to? Would this be good for social studies, or is this only good for professional development, and so on? Trying it out, seeing where it fit, and so on and so forth. But the most interesting thing about this whole story to me is that the whole thing took place on a Saturday. A Saturday before coffee. Roughly, it was around 9 or 10 a.m. on the East Coast, which means for you guys, it was earlier, okay? And what's stunning to me is that there were so many educators on a Saturday that were waking up and checking in with their network, with their community. You know, maybe even before their kids even got up or before getting their day started, they wanted to check in to see what they could learn. How fascinating is that? And what a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to be a part of. This is what we're trying to avoid. But in the traditional model, really, professional development comes in drips and drabs. It comes a few times per year during the in-service day that may or may not pertain to you, and then sometimes you actually get the treat, the candy, the dessert, which is coming to a conference like this, where you can really kind of collaborate with each other face-to-face and so on and so forth. But the problem is those are few and far between for most people. That's the beautiful thing about these new online communities that people are participating on, is that those networks are always there and are always feeding in and sharing with each other. So, just to make it very clear, because some people say to me, are you really trying to suggest that I spend more time on the internet? Raise your hand if you have too many free periods. Not too many. Okay, none. I'm not saying spend more time on the internet. What I am saying is, if you take the time to establish your little network, if you take the time to connect to a community of teachers, then you don't need to spend more time on the internet. That takes some time. But once you get past that, well, then all of a sudden it starts feeding into you. It starts feeding into you. You need to be more efficient with that time you do spend. So, as a means for demonstrating this, I like doing this little experiment. Hypothetically, you got one prep period, you got one free period. Let's just say we're on top to bottom, after you shuffle the kids off and after before you need to go pick them up, you got maybe a good half hour of time. Half hour of time. Is that really enough time to do anything? Is that really enough time to kind of broaden your mind in any sort of way or get any real good, significant, in-depth professional development? Well, let's find out. So, here's what I did. And I did this just about 2 days ago. I decided to see what I could learn just from four places, four common places. Twitter, Delicious, Facebook, and my blogs, up in Google Reader, and so on. So I have taken the time, ahead of time, to make sure that I'm connected to people that I think are worth knowing about, that I think are sharing good things, and so on. So all I was going to do is limit myself to exactly 30 minutes to see what I could learn during that time. Delicious, if you don't know what that is a social bookmarking site. People can bookmark things online and then share them. So all these wonderful people that I'm connected to, they are sharing their bookmarks online, and I can just kind of scroll through and see what they bookmarked yesterday or in the last few days. So I learned about something called Museum Mobile, which is people who are applying microcomputers and such to museums to make the things interactive. A new site called Scavenger, where people are creating a geo-gaming platform that you can take advantage of. So if you want to actually do sort of an elaborate geocaching thing at your own school, you can do that. 10 things your students can blog about today. This is done by Lee Colbert, a Star Discovery educator in Palm Beach, Florida, where she actually, you know, if you want to start blogging with your students, these are 10 suggested ideas that you can start doing immediately, right now. But then the one that really hit me was, how should school principals be less selected in Chicago? Since I'm from Chicago, you know, apparently there's being a big change in the Chicago public school system for how they actually select their principals. I did not even know that was happening, so that was fantastic for me. That was just in the first 10 minutes. Now, I didn't read through all of those 100%. Some of them I flagged to come back to later. Some of them I didn't actually print out so I could read them at my leisure at some other point. Then I hopped over to Facebook. Blogging and Web 2.0 connected classroom, social media in the classroom. That looked like an interesting article, so I flagged that for later. Just for personal reasons, I got a kick out of Betty White coming back to host Saturday Night Live. For those who didn't know, there was actually a Facebook group that was trying to get Betty White to be the host of Saturday Live, and you know what? They listened to their fans, and they are going to be doing that on May 8th. But the one that really hit me was in Florida again. On March 10th, the House and the Senate adopted positions eliminated all funding for the Florida State Aid to Public Libraries program. That's shocking and stunning to me, and that's something I'm going to actually do something about. I got to find out how I can help, if there's any way that I can help to combat this. I mean, I don't live in Florida, but at the same time, that's one of those things that can have ripple effects throughout the rest of the country. So that's definitely something I want to be aware of. So thankfully, somebody chose to share that out on Facebook. Then we hop over to blogs. There's a lot of different things to choose from, and actually, I had more articles in there, but for the sake of time, I decided to kind of remove some of them. But this, I thought, was pretty interesting. For those of you that listen to audiobooks at all, the difference between an MP3 file and an audiobook is when you stop an audiobook, it will stay there. So you can go back and listen to it from that point again. Well, if you ever try to listen to a one-hour podcast, it doesn't do that. When you stop the podcast, you have to start over again at the very beginning, and that's really frustrating. So someone posted an article how to turn those regular MP3s into audiobook format. I thought that was actually pretty useful. So that's one thing that I'm definitely going to kind of add to my toolbox so I can do that when I'm on the road. And then that takes us to Twitter. For those of you that are fans of things like Wallwisher, Wallwisher is a wonderful Web 2.0 site that I use all the time. Somebody found a new spin on that called, Spaz. I'm not sure. I haven't played around with it yet, but that seems kind of interesting. 10 things you didn't know that Google Docs could do. That looked like a great article, which I flagged, and I'm forwarding it on to a couple friends of mine that use Google Docs extensively. Then I also really love this little one. What advice can you offer new teachers for surviving their first year? And they put a little hashtag on there. So if you click on that, you'll see about 20 or 30 comments that people have left as advice for new teachers. What a great little thing to forward on if you have any new teachers in your district, just as a little bit of a mentorship thing. We actually have, through Discovery, we've got a new teacher survival center with, you know, tips and tricks and suggestions and all that. But also, it's nice to be able to connect to other people that have some ideas and suggestions. So I found I could do that through Twitter. That was all within half an hour. You exhausted? I mean, it was exhausted too, because there was just almost too much. How often do you say, I learned too much during my free period? You see what I mean? Normally, if anything, this is about all I would learn during my free period. What was going to be for lunch that day? So point being, yes, it takes some time and effort to set up those things, to find the right blogs to follow, to connect to the right people on Facebook, or connect to the right people on Delicious or Twitter, and so on. But once you do so, the reward is ongoing. You know, a friend of mine, Dean Shoresky, uses this analogy. He calls all the people that he follows on Twitter, he considers them to be his research team. Every night he goes to bed and they get to work. And when he wakes up in the morning, he gets to see what the kind of results they've provided for him, what they've discovered, what they've found, what they've decided to share overnight. This is what we obviously still need to avoid, though. Okay. Sometimes I ask you to raise your hand if this was you, but to be honest, I don't really want to know. Now it's gotten to be such a problem in some sense that they've actually got websites, Web 2.0 sites, that do nothing more than check to see what Web 2.0 sites you're on. How many of you have registered for a site and not remember that you registered for it and don't have to
Web 2.0
sites?
I don't want
to. This is username check. You put in your username, it'll actually check to see. see what sites you're even registered on. Do not take this as a to-do list. Okay? This is not a challenge to see if you can get on all of them. There's another site that I personally love called AdamKey, which saves a tremendous amount of time. You know how you have your profile on this site and on this site and on this site and on this site, and then if you move or get a new phone number or something like that, you're in theory supposed to change them on all of those sites? This one synchronizes them. It synchronizes across all of them. You say, I have a profile on this site, this site, this site, this site, this site, this site, this site. Then you change your phone number once, and it synchronizes it across all of them. Tremendous time saver. There's stuff like that out there if you're connected to people that will let you know about this kind of stuff, and that's kind of the key. So, we've talked a lot about social media and so on as a connection between other teachers and so on, but how does it actually really fit into education and such? There are some schools that are trying to do some phenomenal things in terms of using things like Twitter as a means to communicate with their parents. I mean, you can see New York schools are doing that. This is in Tampa, Florida, Hillsboro, and so on. Look, 852 followers right there in Georgia, 803 in Alabama, and so on. They're pushing out all these different updates and so on, 703 followers in Texas and so on and so forth. The one trouble with all of these is that they all seem to be missing one key critical element. That's people. They're pushing out a lot of information, but what they're not doing is bringing the community back in and engaging them in conversation. I mean, if you take a look at this, Oswego Schools in Oregon, 703 people are there. That's great. Tomorrow's the due date for this. We had a power outage, so we expect that to be there. It's all one-way information. In fact, someone, Lee Colbert, the same person I mentioned earlier, she put together a Google Doc where people could say, is this my school Twitter account and this is how I'm using it? Well, if you actually look through it, you'll see it's district updates, breaking news, updates from Classroom Flickr, the daily cafeteria breakfast and lunch menu. That's a thrilling Twitter account. But what they're missing is the opportunity to actually engage in their audience. That there's all these people that have said, I want to connect to you. But they're not actually connecting back. That's one of the beautiful things about some of these tools. There's such a simple way to make this connection. You know, the whole idea of this accountability movement, the things that led to NCLB and so on and so forth. You know, parents, let's face it, we all just want to know that what's happening in the classroom is what's good for our students and so on. We want to know what's going on. And let's face it, the Friday newsletter doesn't quite really bring them in. And plus, I hated those things. Sorry. But there's a lot of different things that we can do to really engage in our community, to engage our parents and so on. This is the one that I love. It's Honolulu, a school in Honolulu. Not only do they have 1,098 followers, they're following all of those people back. And they are listening to them. If you actually look through the tweets, you can see they're responding to the people that talk to them, responding to them, wishing them, you know, engaging in personal conversation with them. It doesn't take a lot of time, but even just a little bit does works wonders. Same thing you'll see in you know, throughout Facebook and so on. It's people that are actually engaging in these conversations. This is a library media center that I absolutely love. Whenever somebody comes to them with a question, usually the library media specialist will just look up the answer, right? No big deal. Well, this time, what she actually does also is she puts it out on Twitter. So if any member of the community that's following it has a different answer or a suggestion and so on and so forth, a link, a reference and so on, they can respond back. So you're crowdsourcing it as well and engaging in these people that actually want to participate in it. There's a school in Seattle where the kindergarten room tweets now throughout the entire day. Tweets throughout the day. The kids know whenever they something significant happens, an aha moment, the light bulb moment, the teachable moment, and so on and so forth, they can share it via Twitter. They said that's worth tweeting about. 140 characters, click submit. It's not disruptive. It's too short to be disruptive. It's, you know what I mean? It's just these light little touches that then keep the parent community and the greater community involved in touch and let them feel a sense of ownership with it. High touch, high frequency, and the tap piece is so little it's almost invisible. If Twitter isn't the right solution, that's fine. There's other solutions like Edmodo and a few other sites where you can keep them all behind the firewall or behind the password if you so desire. The idea, I love this term, it's an article down below, ambient intimacy. Lots of small, little touches breeds a sense of intimacy, a very deep relationship between the parent and the classroom, between the parent and the teacher, between the students and the, you know, the greater community, and so on, through these light little touches that, while any single one of them may not be that significant, over time, they do become very significant. And you can see from some of the research, lots and lots of parents say that they don't talk to their teachers as much as they'd like to, and the same thing goes in the other direction. Jeff Utek had a great comment on his blog saying that for the first time in the history of education, not only do we have to spend time on the student, but on re-educating our community what it means to learn in today's world. We have that ability. We have that opportunity. We just have to make sure that we're taking the initiative to do so. This is a diagram of this room right now.
It's true.
You are here. Okay? But hopefully, as you go through the conference, and as you go to some of these different sessions, as you find something new, it won't end with you. Hopefully, instead of just being there, you'll be there or there or there. You won't be one of these nodes out here at the end. You'll be one of these. You know, maybe this is the person who's doing the presenting. But maybe you're going to be there and telling 10 or 12 other people within your district, making sure that other people who haven't heard these messages, that haven't seen these tools, that haven't heard these ideas and so on, that you're passing that information along. Whether you do it in person and face-to-face, or whether you take advantage of some of these other communities. It's very easy, and a lot of people assume that since you're just learning about it, everyone else knows it. That's not true. In fact, raise your hand if you feel like you're behind the technology curve. Look around real quick. It's a curve. It's not possible for you to all be behind it. You can't be. Some of you are dead center, some of you are ahead of it without even realizing it. And that's the key, is to make sure that you take the things that you're learning, and regardless of whether you think other people may have heard before, regardless if you're not the first person to discover it, that you treat it as your obligation to share it out with other people in so many different ways. That's the whole core of the program that I work with in Discovery Education. In fact, Justin and Jen, I can't even see you back there. Are you still there, or did you already leave? All right, they might have already left. I can't tell. Anyway, she was waving her hand. Yeah, that person, the black, the dark person, shadow in the corner. We all work with something called the Discovery Educator Network. The entire idea behind the program is that our goal is to make sure that the knowledge that we have or the passion that we've got for integrating digital media in the classroom is shared out by other people. We're connecting teachers to their most valuable resource, each other, making sure the whole idea behind the program is you learn something from us, your obligation is to turn around and share it with other people. That's what the entire thing is built around. And now we've got over 140,000 members of our community, about 4,500 of which are Starting Discovery Educators. They're the top evangelists, and their primary purpose in being a member of that community is that they will take what they've learned and make sure that they do their due diligence and share it out with others. That's the key. Even at a conference like this, there are so many different ways to share. Face-to-face is a wonderful way to share, but then there are blogs, there are podcasts, there are back channels, there's Twitter, there's live video, Skype casting, and so on and so forth. There's so many different ways to share this information that it'd be such a shame if you were one of those end nodes and you just kind of kept it to yourself. The other piece of it is, like we were talking about at the very beginning with my son, the trouble is there's so much information these kids are putting out there on a social level that it's hard for the really good stuff that they're doing to trickle up towards the top, to be represented, unless it's done very deliberately and very carefully. A current trend that we're seeing more and more often is for job seekers, especially in today's economy, they're not just creating the resume and submitting it in. They're creating things like social media resumes. These are websites that gather together not just what they have done in the past, but what they are doing right now, their current passions, whether they have a job or not, what they're very interested in doing and so on and so forth. My wife is a wonderful example of this in some sense. When she got laid off, instead of just trying to find a new job, I mean, she did try to find a new job, thankfully. But what she also did was she created a social network called Jobless in Chicago. She created a name, Jobless in Chicago. And you know what? Not only did several hundred people flock to it and join and start sharing tips and ideas and tricks and so on, they had get-togethers, social get-togethers, and then some resume writers said, hey, listen, we love what you're doing. Can we volunteer to come and give those people tips and so on? She wound up being, within 2 months of starting this thing up, she was on the news twice. She was in the newspaper three times. She was in Chicago Magazine. Not because she was an expert on being unemployed, although I guess she but because she chose to try and do something about it instead of just waiting for it. So, social media resumes, these are places where not only are you going to see a list of things that are done, but let's face it, you take one person's resume or one person's bio compared to someone else's, compared to someone else's, A lot of times they all start to look the same after a little while. And not only that, if you were to look through my resume, you would not know who I am. You would not be able to hear my voice. You would not be able to know what I'm passionate about and what I'm doing and, you know, how I spend my time and so on. These kinds of things do, because you're connecting in things like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and actually having a video message and so on and so forth. You're demonstrating your passion and your knowledge. And this is something that I think actually we should be thinking about for our students. Not just the digital portfolio, which is a list of things that you have done, but also this social media resume, which is the things that they are doing, what they are passionate about. And the main reason that really drove this home for me is a kid named Judson. Judson was a fan of a website called CrowdSpring. CrowdSpring is a graphic design site, so people can submit a job. I have a job in CrowdSpring right now. We have a summer institute coming up over the summer. We want a t-shirt for it. We don't really know exactly what we want on a t-shirt, so I was able to post the job. I said, all right, so I want a t-shirt. Here's the key elements we think we do want. Here's our logos. See what you can come up with. At the end of 2 weeks, one person's going to get $250. Well, I anticipate we'll probably get about 80 or 100 people submitting in ideas, and then at the end, we'll say, you win. Is that my phone? Okay. By the way, all of you guys should keep your phone on silent during your presentation. Point being, Judson was a fan of this site. He's a high school student. At one point, they put out something that said they were looking for a new online community manager. He thought, wow, that would be a great job for me. I'd love to be their online community manager. So here's what he did. He didn't send in a resume. He did not send in a bio. He did not send in an application. Instead, he sent them this.
This is so good.
Ah, stop that. Hold on. No, ignore the black bar. Because you can't read it, you might have seen the email I sent you. I like to pat myself on the back just a little bit. I kid. But seriously, you'd be rocking if you hired me as a community manager. I'm a Twitter addict. Yep, now he's getting back on fix. And so on and so forth. Okay? This is what he sent them. He did not get the job. They created a job for him. They thought that that wasn't the right, they didn't want to hire a high school student to do that job full time, and they needed somebody full time. They didn't want him to drop out of high school for it, so they created a community evangelist position that he could do part time while he finished his high school degree and so on. That's the direction that things are going. And that's the kind of things that we need to be preparing our students to do. And there's so many different ways to do it. There's not just one set form or one set way to do it. There's so many different communities that people can be a part of that you can do in schools with your students and so on and so forth. So I often get asked what kind of things come next. Right now, obviously, a few years ago, blogs were the big thing. Then came podcasts. Podcasts were the big thing. Right now, Twitter is obviously a big thing, and Facebook and so on and so forth. But projecting outward, what should we know about? I mean, we're here at the microcomputers in education. I'm sorry. What do we need to keep an eye on? We're going to stay ahead of that, honey, you know, that head, you know, that wave. So this is where the evolution chain is as of right now. Basically three trends that you need to know about. And I'm going to kind of give you my ideas about how this fits into education, but I don't have all the answers because these things aren't, for the most part, too new. We've got real-time broadcasting, geo applications, and something called augmented reality. The broadcasting piece of it is simply this. There are tools like Ustream that will allow you to broadcast through your iSight camera or through your webcam and so on, live, out to the real world, you know, in real time, absolutely free and so on. Then there's things like Kick, and actually Ustream has an app now too, that allows you to do the exact same thing, but via your cell phone. With one button, I can start broadcasting out live to a real-time audience via my cell phone from anywhere, which I know is also the kind of scary part about it. But not hard at all. But then you take that one step further, and you have something called live stream. Mm-hmm. Live stream is an entire TV studio within your browser. It will allow you to do subtitles, over-the-shoulder graphics, a crawl along the bottom. It will allow you to do multiple cameras and feed back and forth between them. You can do a live broadcast and then cut to something pre-recorded and then cut back all in real time. But then, not only that, it plays nicely with things like Kik, which is the cell phone mm-hmm. one. So you could have a student outside doing the weather report and then cutting back to someone inside doing the rest of the school broadcast. You could have 8 students around the floor of the basketball game and one person up, you know, on a web connection who's managing all those different live feeds. And it's free. It's stunning. This is not one of those Web 2.0 sites where you can just get in and get on with it in like 5 minutes. It'll take right. you a few hours to kind of get the hang of it. It's pretty complicated and robust. Wait, why is it so robust? Because people like the USA Today and professional news sites and NPR are using this exact same site. Mm-hmm. It's stunning. It's stunning the kinds of things that are absolutely free now. And that's something we can take advantage of in education. How? I'm not sure. But that's something we got to figure out because this is becoming more and more ubiquitous. It's becoming more and more transparent. We have access to this stuff. When we have this kind of power at our fingertips for free, what the heck can we do with that? Then we come to things like geo-applications. Sites like Almost App. Almost App will aggregate together all the photos, videos, and live messages from a single geographic area. Like, for example, a conference. Now, this one, it won't have NEC in there because it has, you have, you know, it's still in a private beta, so they need to set it up for you and so on. But just imagine, just by having this thing set up within a certain geographic area, anything that is broadcast, you know, photos, videos, tweets, Facebook posts, and so on, it can aggregate them together in one screen. Now, think about doing that for your school. If we actually allow students to be using our cell phones and actually be doing publishing throughout the day and using these technologies that they're hiding in their backpacks right now, we could actually allow parents at any given time to drop in and see the learning that is happening at the school right at that moment. Or to be able to rewind in the day and be able to see through the timeline what happened at that school throughout the day. I know, that's kind of scary in some sense. But it's becoming more and more transparent. It's possible. Then there's like sites like Foursquare, which are taking that same technology. It's basically Twitter, if you add the locational aspect of it. So whenever you went somewhere, this is something that a lot of people, they apply some game elements and so on. You say, I'm at this location, here's what I'm doing, and then it kind of tweaks out so other people can join you and so on. Of course, some of you for sure are thinking that the flip side is also possible. Someone put together a website called Please Rob Me. People on Foursquare and Gowalla and so on, where they let you know when people aren't home. Kind of does, you know, we're still figuring how this stuff all fits in. We're still figuring all that kind of stuff out. And there are no easy answers. Then comes the third one, which I was mentioning, called augmented reality. Augmented reality is essentially, when you take a webcam and hold something that has a certain code on it, and what it does is on the computer screen, it will turn that into a 3D object that you're controlling by moving the paper around. This is actually at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. You just hold this little piece of cardboard with the picture of the brain on it and so on. And as you tilt it, you can control the 3D model on the screen. That's pretty cool. That's pretty high tech. But is that something we could really use in schools realistically? Well, yeah. There's a company called Mindspace Solutions. They have a product called Imaginality. You can download this for the PC right now. They have some free modules, and the rest of them cost about $100 a piece or so on and so forth. But you literally just print out these little cards on your laser printer. You hold them up underneath your webcam, and you'll have to forgive, this is done at my office, so the lighting isn't exactly perfect. But when you move them in front of the webcam, they turn into a 3D object that you can control. Not only that, you can take other cards and hold them up and they will interact together. So that one turns it, makes it transparent and so on. We can move that one out of the way. This one will get you one of the aortas and the ventricles, and when you put two of them together, they will actually interact with each other and form. You see what I mean?
Whoa.
And then you can split them, you can actually form the entire human arc, and then that card over there will actually give you more information about anything that's near it, so you can see the left atrium receives oxygen and blood and so on and so forth. I know, isn't that amazing? That's the future that you can download now. And then I love this one over here. All right, let's stop that one. This is one that they, another module they have for the planets. So you hold it over there, we can see, is that Jupiter or Pluto? Mercury. That's Mercury right there, and it's hard to see, but Mercury is actually rotating at the same speed that would normally really, you know, rotate, at least proportionally and so on. There's the Earth, you can see that one's rotating a little faster. And when you hold them up against each other, near each other, they size themselves proportionally. So there's the Earth, here comes Saturn, and so on. Move the Earth next to Saturn, you'll see the Earth is going to shrink down to about the size of a marble. See what I mean? And all these other things that you see on the corners here are other pieces of information. So of course, you got to wonder about the Sun, right? So you move the Sun over there, and you take Saturn, which was giant when you compare it to the Earth, and you move that next to the Sun, and then all of a sudden you'll see how small that one's going to wind up getting. Isn't that amazing? Now here's the trick, though. That's amazing. That is cool. That's got you gut instinct. That's got educational implications, right? How could you use that in your classroom? The people that are creating this are programmers. They are 3D modelers. They are not educators. So it is, once again, our responsibility to see the potential there and to think ourselves, I could really use that in the classroom if ... and then to let them know. Let them know what you need so they can make it. It's the same thing that happens with so many of these Web 2.0 sites. You take a site like Gloster. Gloster, we're going to be talking about it in the Discovery Education corporate room quite a bit today, because you can create multimedia posters. The trouble is, when Gloster was created, it was intended to be used by angst-driven teens to express their appreciation of Lady Gaga. Okay? That's how it was intended to be used. It wasn't until educators took a look at that and said, you know what, I could really use that in my classroom if ... if you got rid of the inappropriate material, if you made it so I could publish privately, if you made it so I could create my own account and allow my students to log in through me, if I could set up my own student account so they don't need their email addresses. Well, some teachers took the time to do that, and they followed through, and they created edu.gloster.com,
yes.
And that was a wonderful, wonderfully rich tool that we can use as educators. But it's our responsibility to not get hung up on what they've already done, but to tell them what they need to be doing. That's what the big key that often gets lost. So, just to sum up, the problem is, in my mind, the box of Legos syndrome. This is what I call it, the box, because I'm a kindergarten teacher, I'm a simple man. Most of us, if you buy this box of Legos, and you bring those Legos home, what are you going to build?
That.
And if you take it apart, and then decide to build something new, what are you going to build?
That.
Spaceship. You're going to see that, you're going to see the box, you're going to build that, you're going to build a spaceship. And no matter how many times you take apart those Legos and put them together, you're still in your head going to be fixated on spaceship, when all they are is just bricks, and you could really build anything. You could build anything from them, but because they came in that package, in that box, that's what you get fixated on. It's a real problem, I'm not saying you, it's me too, it's everybody. That's what happens. I know, isn't that amazing? And we instead, all we get fixated on is that idea of the spaceship. So, the whole, if you take nothing else away from this, something called the Medici effect. That breakthroughs and innovations occur at the intersection of cultures and ideas and disciplines. It's what happens when somebody who's not a programmer takes a look at something a programmer has created and says, I can do something completely different than that. That's what we're kind of going for here. It's not just the digital natives or the people who are immersed in technology and says, this is how I can use it. It's when the 30-year educator says, wow, I've got this realm of experience, I could apply it here and do something completely different. A great example of this is Twitter. Twitter was intended to let, 140 characters to let people know what you ate for breakfast this morning. And yet people have done some incredibly innovative things with it. For example, somebody who had trouble with the washing machine, he would put his wash in, and 3 days later he'd forget that it was there and he'd have an interesting science experiment on his hands. But he's on Twitter 80, 90 times a day. So, he rigged up a little device, so whenever the washing machine was done, it would send him a tweet. Trust me when I say this is not how the founders of Twitter intended it to be used. Twitter and a houseplant. Same sort of thing, exactly. Someone invented this little device that you can actually buy. You can buy this at thinkgeek.com right now, and you can set it up. Not only does it let you know when it needs to be watered, it will mock you when you overwater it. Once again, not how the founders intended it to be used at all. Twitter and the house cat. Someone who has a couple cats and they have that little cat door. They never knew whether the cats were inside the house or outside the house. So, pretty cheap, actually. They set a little something up, so whenever the cat went in or out of the house, they were able to see it. So they knew who was inside the house. And the greatest thing about it is they also rigged up a digital camera, so whenever the cat came in or out, it took a picture of them. They pushed it as well. But this one is my favorite, right here. I know, you think it's crossing a line, maybe, but... Twitter and the unborn baby. A father who wanted to be more in tune with his wife's pregnancy. He just developed this little belt that he put around, you know, his wife could wear. And then whenever the baby would kick, it would send him a tweet. If you actually go to kick me right now, you'll see I'm not going to kick mommy anymore because I was bored yesterday. Maybe I'll use Twitter soon. And what do you know, just a few weeks or a few months after that, he had his own Twitter account. See, once again, far different than what the founders of Twitter intended it to be used for. The same idea can be applied with education. It's what happens when a 30-year language arts teacher takes a look at Google Earth. And most people, when we take a look at Google Earth, most people are thinking geography, or you're thinking social studies. Maybe you're even thinking world history or that sort of stuff. But when a 30-year language arts teacher looks at that and says, you know what, that would be a great way to tell the stories from classic literature. That would be a great way to tell the story of the Odyssey, or Great Gatsby, or Huckleberry Finn, or even Make Way for Ducklings. I love that. Make Way for Ducklings. As these ducks journey around the Boston area, put push pins in at each of their locations, actually include real photos and so on and so forth. And that's when he created something called Google Lit Trips, a guy named Jerome Berg out of California. Google Lit Trips, using Google Earth as a storytelling engine. Not the way anyone ever intended Google Earth to be used, but applying his realm of experience to these new technologies. And that, to me, is the real key. Not to get hung up on the box of Legos. At this conference, you are going to learn about a slew of new technologies. You're going to see some wonderful projects. Use those as examples. Use these sites and the stuff that they have as the showcase on those sites as examples. Don't just try to recreate the things that you see other people doing, but make sure that you keep your mind open to say, wow, here's what I could do if I applied my own little breadth of knowledge to what they're doing, and get creative. Don't be afraid to experiment, and if the tool doesn't suit your needs, it's your obligation to tell them how they should change it so that it will. Give them the opportunity to make those tweaks so that they will suit your needs. So, just to, in summary, or just to kind of close, how do we predict the class of the 21st century? Well, for one thing, we've got to start asking this question, because the class of the 21st century is now a decade old. Okay? That's one thing. And the other piece of it is, if you really want to predict the class of the 21st century or the class of the future, the easiest way to do that is just simply to invent it. And that's what your obligation, that's what your duty is. Thank you very much. I hope you have a great day.